We are entering the 30th chapter today, and this is a continuation of this real long prophecy to Egypt and about Egypt. And what is important to remember with this real long prophecy is that it covers the period from about 585 B.C. until yet future to us, the millennial kingdom. We're going to see that in this prophecy today as we continue with this prophecy against Egypt. And I'm going to read the first 19 verses of the chapter 30 in the book of Ezekiel. The word of Jehovah came again unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy and say, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, wail ye, alas for the day is near, even the day of Jehovah is near. It shall be a day of clouds, a time of the nations, and a sword shall come upon Egypt, and anguish shall be in Ethiopia, when the slain shall fall in Egypt, and they shall take away her multitude, and her foundation shall be broken down. Ethiopia, and Put, and Lud, and all the mingled people and cub, and the children of the land that is in league, shall fall with them by the sword. Thus saith Jehovah, they also that uphold Egypt shall fall, and the pride of her power shall come down. From the tower of Sebna shall they fall in it by the sword, saith the Lord Jehovah. And they shall be desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and her cities shall be in the midst of the cities that are wasted. And they shall know that I am Jehovah, when I have set a fire in Egypt, and all her helpers are destroyed. In that day shall messengers go forth from before me in ships to make the careless Ethiopians afraid, and there shall be anguish upon them, as in the day of Egypt, for lo, it cometh. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, I will also make the multitude of Egypt to cease by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He and his people, with him, the terrible of the nations, shall be brought in to destroy the land, and they shall draw their swords against Egypt and fill the land with the slain. And I will make the rivers dry, and I will sell the land into the hand of evil men, and I will make the land desolate, and all that is therein by the hand of strangers. I, Jehovah, have spoken it. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, I will also destroy the idols, and I will cause the images to cease from Memphis, and there shall be no more a prince from the land of Egypt, and I will put fear in the land of Egypt, and I will make Paphos desolate, and I will set a fire in Zoan, and I will execute judgments upon No. And I will pour my wrath upon Sin, the stronghold of Egypt, and I will cut off the multitude of No, and I will set a fire in Egypt. Sin shall be in great anguish, and No shall be broken up, and Memphis shall have adversaries in the daytime. The young men of Aven and of Pibeseth shall fall by the sword, and these cities shall go into captivity. At Tophanes, also the day shall withdraw itself, when I shall break there the yokes of Egypt, and the pride of her power shall cease in her. As for her, a cloud shall cover her, and her daughters shall go into captivity. Thus will I execute judgments upon Egypt, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. Wow. This is one of the stronger sections of the condemnation towards Egypt. And the first nine verses in this chapter here are really focusing on the Great Tribulation, the Day of the Lord, the Tribulation, if you will. And I'm going to go into that into some detail, and I'm going to break that section up into two sections. So let's look at the first five verses. The word of Jehovah came again unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy and say, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, wail ye, alas for the day is near, even the day of Jehovah is near. It shall be a day of clouds, a time of the nations, and a sword shall come upon Egypt, and anguish shall be in Ethiopia, when the slain shall fall in Egypt, and they shall take away her multitude, and her foundations shall be broken down. Ethiopia, and Put, and Lud, and all the mingled peoples, and Cub, and the children of the land that is in league shall fall with them by the sword. The way this one starts out, the word of Jehovah came again unto me. You get the sense that Ezekiel is receiving these messages from God and beginning to start to feel really bad about what it is that is going to happen, because it's one judgment after another. The prophet in general were charged with bringing some very difficult news to these people. It was very, very sobering. And as we've seen in other passages, they were not to gloat over somebody getting the vengeance of God, no matter how bad they were. The prophets were not to gloat. They were to deliver the message with firmness, but not with glee. You know, they weren't supposed to go out there and say, you're getting what you deserve, so there. No, they were supposed to deliver this message with some compassion. Not necessarily in a matter-of-fact way, but in a way, because we've seen all these different things that Ezekiel did. He built little siege mounds, and he had all kinds of different little construction projects and ways of talking to them and trying to give it to them in parables. And the idea was, God said, cause them to understand. Cause them to understand. God is eternally merciful, but he's judgmental too, because he's got rules and they're going to be followed. And if people don't follow them, there will be a judgment. But the prophet is not to gloat. So the prophet has got this tough job of telling these people these really sober messages about what's going to happen. But he's got to do it with some degree of compassion. And especially to the people of Israel. Especially to the people of Israel. And we have to remember that too. Because this, throughout this book, we've seen that it's not appropriate to gloat over somebody getting what's due to them. We should have compassion with them too. Not for what they've done. I'm not saying you forgive somebody and you ignore it. That's not the case here. It's you see where they are, you see what they're doing, and you see what happens to them for doing it. You can have compassion and understanding, but at the same time, who caused this? You know, who caused this? You did. Because of the context of this chapter, it's important to understand that this prophecy to Egypt, which is going to cover a lot of chapters, is the biggest one in this book. Pulling out the nation of Israel, which is throughout the whole Bible, this one is the largest prophecy to a Gentile nation in this book, and in the Old Testament even. This particular time period at the beginning of this chapter is the Great Tribulation. The day of the Lord is a very, very specific Hebrew term. Hayom Yehoah. It's a very, very specific term. And it refers to God bringing his judgment on this world finally, because he's finally run out of patience. It hasn't happened yet. It's still yet future to us. Now, Egypt is the principal subject of these chapters. But this particular section of verses 1 to 9 is talking about the tribulation. For example, Nebuchadnezzar is given Egypt as a prize for not getting any spoils in Tyre, which is up in Lebanon. And after he sieged it for 13 years. Can you imagine that? Sieging it for 13 years, and he finally conquers them, and there's nothing there. There's nothing there. They had moved all of their spoils, or what would be desirable to him, offshore to the island part of Tyre that Alexander would subsequently conquer in the early 300s. Nebuchadnezzar couldn't do that. He didn't have the skills that Alexander did. And he was, after working for 13 years, you know, and the last chapter told us these guys were worn out. I mean, their shoulders were down and their heads were bald from wearing the helmets and doing all the work and all that. And they get done and there's no payment. Good grief. Nobody wants to work and then not get paid. So God gives him Egypt. He sends him down to Egypt. That was 585 B.C. And other passages state that Egypt is going to be desolate for 40 years. Well, that hasn't happened yet. So what we have to do when we're looking at all of these prophecies for Egypt is try and section out when we think these things are actually going to happen or have happened. The 40-year desolation hasn't happened yet. It's going to be in the millennial kingdom. So when this passage states the day of Jehovah is near, it's referencing the tribulation. It's like when the Lord Jesus came, he said, your salvation is nearer now than it was before. And he's talking about the millennial kingdom. He's talking about the kingdom was at hand. And it was, he was offering the kingdom, but it doesn't mean it was actually starting right then. This day of Jehovah is something to really understand because clearly the multitude of passages in the Old Testament and the New Testament that I put into your notes there show that this is a time of God's judgment, final judgment on the world. He's finally judging sin. And he's very, very, very patient, long-suffering, very, very patient. He's judging sin. He's going to evangelize the world during that period of time like it's never been evangelized before. He's going to break the will of the Jewish people and bring them to his Messiah. Now, so that term, Day of Jehovah, is really important to understand because it just covers the tribulation. There are Bible commentators that I've looked at in various venues that are trying to say, well, this, it must mean that the Day of Jehovah must mean that it's just a judgment. And this judgment here that Nebuchadnezzar brings is the Day of Jehovah. Well, it's not, because all the other places it's used is talking about the tribulation. You know, you can't take 40 passages that refer to something in unity and then look at one that doesn't seem to and say, well, it must mean something else. No, it means the same thing as that. The same thing as that. The judgment of Egypt is the beginning of the judgment of all the Gentile nations. This is the judgment that God starts with, the judgment of the Gentile nations. 586 B.C. inaugurated what the Lord Jesus called the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles are a period of time starting with 586 B.C. when the Babylonians, after three sieges, well, actually the first two in 605 and 597 weren't really sieges. Nebuchadnezzar just came in and said, look, I'm taking over. Which he did. It was a bloodless coup, if you will, because they had weak kings in the southern tribe of Judah. And he came in there in 586 B.C., but he destroyed Jerusalem. And that's when the times of the Gentiles started. And then the Babylonians get judged. It wasn't too many years later when the Persians conquered the Babylonians. This is the second stage, if you will, of the judgment of the Gentiles. Because the first nation is Egypt. Then the Babylonians get judged. God uses the Persians, the Medes and the Persians. Then the Medes and the Persians get judged, and God uses the Greeks. Then the Greeks get judged, and God uses two entities, He uses the Maccabeans to rise up in the Judaism, in the Jewish culture. They don't last long, though, because the Romans come in and conquer them. And the last empire, the Romans, are going to get judged when the tribulation is finally over. The last two, they're not Romans per se. That's just the first stage of that last empire. They're imperialists. They're imperialists. Because what Rome set in place was not the Roman government, was the system of imperialism, which is what all the Western democracies follow. Imperialism is not necessarily bad. It just means you seek to influence your neighbors. You can influence them through diplomatic relations, and you can influence them through by committing war acts against them. it just means you're influencing your nations. What the Romans did was they would go out, they would conquer an area militarily, and set up what they called the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. They would let the standing government there run itself, but they had to report to Rome. It really wasn't a bad system as long as you kept the peace and you obeyed the laws of your own country even. So they set up imperialism. The very first Gentile nation, though, to be judged by God is Egypt, and that's what this long prophecy is about, the very first judgment of the Gentile. This judgment, over time, is going to be so violent that it's going to overwhelm even Egypt's neighbors. And that's what all these names are here. They're listing other countries that are in North Africa. Ethiopia is actually listed here, but it's an English translation of Cush, which is the Hebrew word. When our Bibles are translated into English from Hebrew, frequently the translators will use a word that the Hebrew word means. Instead of just translating the actual word and saying, okay, it's Cush. They'll say, oh, wait a minute, Cush is Ethiopia. Let's call it Ethiopia. And they do that to try and let us see what this Bible is saying a little easier than just saying Cush. And we see this in Micah 2:12, where instead of calling the word Basra, which is a city in southern Jordan, where the Jews are going to flee during the tribulation for safety, the translator is a sheepfold, which is what Basra means, but the name of the city is Basra, and today it's Petra. So frequently the Bible does that. Both Cush and Egypt were sons of Ham. Ham was one of the sons, probably the least of the sons of Noah. The Hebrew name for Egypt is Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim. And Put is also one of Ham's sons. Lud is one of Mitzrayim's sons. And that's presently Libya. Kub, we have no idea what that is. Because it's what we call hapax legomenon. In other words, it only appears once. And that's just a general dictionary or lexicon type term. A hapax legomenon just means, boy, this thing falls in this group of words that appears in the Bible one time. We have no idea what it means because we can't translate it. We don't have other contextual situations to place that word for comparison. Same thing is true from the anointed cherub that became Satan. His name in Hebrew is Halal. And people have tried to translate that all kinds of strange ways. They tried to translate it as Lucifer and Son of the Morning and a few other things. His name is Halal. And the reason that the translators have a difficult time with it, because it falls in that category of the hapax legomenon. It only appears one time. So people keep guessing. They even look to other cultures, other ancient cultures, to see that word's over there, and then they end up using that at times. But all of these nations that are listed here are in North Africa, around Egypt. And they're all closely associated, as well as Israel, because they had pacts or agreements or treaties with Egypt. Remember, Egypt was the most powerful nation in the world at that time. There wasn't anybody stronger than Egypt. So all of these nations would come to Egypt with their hats in their hand, begging some kind of a deal for protection. Please help us. Everybody was afraid earlier of the Syrians, now the Babylonians, because of the way they were. The Babylonians were extremely warlike, and everybody was afraid of them. You didn't make friends with the Babylonians. They were going to be enemies of everybody. So God's saying that all of these countries that made deals with Egypt for support are going to fall too. They're all going to fall. I put a chart into your notes that shows us the genealogy coming from Ham. And if you remember back to Genesis chapter 10, these three sons after the flood were all given particular prophecies. Shem was going to be the line that the Messiah came from. The blessed line. Matter of fact, Shem lived 35 years longer than Abraham even. Shem spoke the original language of the world before the languages were confused at Babel. He knew the original language. Abraham knew that language. That's why we make a case that Hebrew was probably the original language of the world. Ham had some sexual problems of some sort. Noah gets drunk. Shouldn't have done that. He got drunk. And Ham did some sexual indiscretion with him. We don't know exactly what it is. And whatever that was, it caused a curse to come in to his son Canaan. But the curse was because of Ham. So that brings some problems to Ham's other sons too. And I put little red arrows there to show you who these particular sons are that pertain to this prophecy here. But let's continue on with the prophecy in the first 9 verses related to the Great Tribulation. Thus saith Jehovah, they also that uphold Egypt shall fall, and the pride of her power shall come down from the tower of Sevenah, shall they fall in it by the sword, saith the Lord Jehovah. And they shall be desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and her cities shall be in the midst of the cities that are wasted. And they shall know that I am Jehovah when I have set a fire in Egypt, and all her helpers are destroyed. In that day shall messengers go forth before me in ships, to make the careless Ethiopians afraid. And there shall be anguish upon them, as in the day of Egypt, for lo, it cometh. It is best always to align yourself with God, not some other nation, some other group, and look for strength in people and governments. Always. These people were aligning themselves with others. Egypt was doing this. This wasn't just the countries that were coming to Egypt for assistance. Egypt wanted an alliance with others for help too. Again, everybody's worried about the Babylonians back then because they were so warlike and so dominant and so merciless. So God now says that this tribulation is going to come on any ally of Egypt, and they're going to suffer too. The pride of the Egyptians is going to be brought down. No one is going to be able to assist them. God's saying, I don't care who your helpers are. And that's one very, very important aspect of this that we have to realize, that God controls everything. Other nations don't control things. The politicians don't control things. And even all the pastors in the pulpits that are telling you stories that are not about what God does, they don't control things either. It is God in his sovereignty that controls everything that takes place. And what God's saying here, these other nations are not going to be able to help you, Egypt. They will not be able to do it. And he's talking about, and he uses like the Tower of Seven. He's referencing the entire country, because Sevena is referring to the complete northern and southern limits of Upper Egypt. Upper Egypt, if you remember, is down in the south because the elevation is higher and the Nile River flows south to north. So if you look at the map and you go, boy, the Nile's flowing up. Well, it's not flowing up, but we get used to looking at maps like that. It's actually flowing exactly the way it should according to the gravitational pull and the elevation. But Upper Egypt is actually in the south. And this is going to be completely destroyed, because the text there says, and they shall be desolate in the midst of the countries that are desolate, and her cities shall be in the midst of the cities that are wasted. And then he goes on to talk about fire going everywhere. Well, fire is a product of warfare. In the ancient times, they would set fires. Modern times, the armaments cause fire. They explode. And they cause big fires. They're saying that because of the effects of the war, people are going to be unable to resist this. You can't stop God's judgment. Once when I was teaching through the book of Revelation, one of the ladies in the class said, oh, we got to stop this. We got to stop this from happening. I said, you're not going to stop God's judgment. The best thing that you can do is tell others about Christ so you're not here when it happens. That's it. You can't stop God's judgment. He's long-suffering. He's patient. But when the time finally comes, he executes his judgment. Here he's talking about Egypt. The time to prevent these things is long before they happen. To protect yourself in God by following him. When it comes, nobody can stop it. It's going to run its course. And the allies here, as I've mentioned, are going to be useless. They're going to be destroyed too. These are mercenaries, and these are other countries that have vowed to help them. They're not going to be able to do it. Now, God then goes back to this land of Cush, the Ethiopians, which is south of Egypt, and he says again, messengers go forth from before me in ships to make the careless Ethiopians afraid. He's not going to harm the Ethiopians, but he's going to shake them up really bad. So he's going to send ships down the Nile to them, and he's going to send messengers down there so that they tell the Ethiopians what's going on. So you get the sense that God wants to shake them up, but he doesn't want to destroy them. The text moves on here. Now he's going to talk for a couple of verses about how this punishment is going to start. And this punishment is going to, again, this whole thing lasts for many, many years. So Ezekiel 30, verses 10 to 12 say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, I will also make the multitude of Egypt to cease by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He and his people with him, the terrible of the nations, shall be brought in to destroy the land. And they shall draw their swords against Egypt and fill the land with the slain. And I will make the rivers dry, and I will sell the land into the hand of evil men, and I will make the land desolate, and all that is therein by the hand of strangers. I, Jehovah, have spoken it. So the Lord here is introducing into the text something called, in grammar, a contrastive construction. And when you pick apart these verses, you find it happens in the Olivet Discourse with the Lord Jesus and some other places too. It is I'm going to shift from what we've been talking about to something related, but it's different. related, but it's different. And that's what this contrast of construction is. So the subject remains Egypt, but he's going to talk about a different aspect of the broad overall judgment of Egypt. Now you're going to talk about Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And this is really true of the whole section of Ezekiel. The judgment of Egypt is the subject of all these prophecies in this multitude of chapters, but it's talking about different times, different aspects of it, and different components. So there's near-term prophecies, and there are far-term prophecies. But he's talking about now, he's shifting from that first nine verses where he's talking about the tribulation, to now he's going to come to where the beginning of their judgment is going to happen, because he goes, I will also make, that's this contrast, it was like a shift. Oh, by the way, I will also. He's shifting how he's talking and about what he's talking about here. Even though Egypt is still the subject. This prophecy came to Ezekiel a year after the Babylonians got into Jerusalem. And this would be January the 5th of 585 BC. The Babylonians, as we mentioned, were extremely cruel. They had no mercy at all. They loved to harm people and break things. That's what they did. God motivated Nebuchadnezzar to come against Egypt. So we can't say that the Babylonians are just all bad, because God used them and he moved them to do this. And we can't say that God is all bad. It's the sin in the world that he wants to correct. That's the problem. This disaster that he's talking about here was Nebuchadnezzar coming in and conquering Egypt, which is the beginning of the judgment of Egypt. And he's talking about the Nile and its tributary rivers drying up. Well, that again has never happened yet. That's what's going to happen sometime yet future to us, probably in the Great Tribulation, because if the rivers of Egypt dry up, there's no life in Egypt. The Nile Delta and the tributaries, the small tributaries around the Nile, are what keep Egypt alive. The rest of the country is just all desert wasteland. They can't sustain any life in the desert. I mean, you might get a few Bedouins here and there, but they're not going to have any water for the most part. So the population can't stay there. This is probably the first 40 years of the Millennial Kingdom. When we know, according to the text of the last chapter, where it states two times, it's going to be desolation, 40 years. Nobody's going to be there. He's going to scatter all the Egyptians. Without the Nile, there is no Egypt. No Egypt. So I'm going to finish up with the last few verses here, where he's talking about the judgment of the individual cities within Egypt. So verses 13 to 19 of chapter 30 say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, I will also destroy the idols, and I will cause the images to cease from Memphis, and there should be no more prince from the land of Egypt. And I will put fear in the land of Egypt, and I will make Pathros desolate, and I will set a fire in Zoan, and I will execute judgment upon No, and I will pour my wrath upon Sin, the stronghold of Egypt, and I will cut up the multitude of No, and I will set a fire in Egypt. Sin shall be in great anguish, and No shall be broken up, and Memphis shall have adversaries in the daytime. The young men of Aven and of Pi-Beseth shall fall by the sword, and these cities shall go into captivity. At Tophonines also the day shall withdraw itself, when I shall break there the yokes of Egypt, and the pride of her power shall cease in her. As for her, a cloud shall cover her, and her daughters shall go into captivity. Thus will I execute judgments upon Egypt, and they shall know that I am Jehovah. And the subject, the focal point, if you will, of this particular section of the judgment of Egypt is coming because of the idolatry, the idols. And we've seen this in previous passages that we've looked at, where they worship the crocodiles, they worship cats, they worship dogs and animals. As a matter of fact, Herodotus, the Greek historian, says that when armies came in to Egypt, they would have a series of cats and dogs in front of the army coming in. And the Egyptians worshiped these things, so they would back off. The armies would back off, and then, the invading army just says, oh, good. It's like we took all your weapons and your will to fight away. That's how crazy they were. They worshiped these things because they did not know God. They knew who God was because Joseph and the Jews went down there and lived for 400 years. So they knew who God was. They turned away from God. It wasn't that they weren't given the true God of the world. So the Lord lists these individual cities, the idols that they had, and these are all cities in ancient Egypt. The idolatry drew the Jews away from God when they were down there for those 400 years. God is judging this. And he says, I'm going to destroy their pride. I'm going to destroy their power. And fire, the components or the net result of warfare, is going to be everywhere. And what we can see by this list of cities is he's discussing the totality of the entire geography. The whole country is going to get judged. And then he ends this thing with darkness is going to fall upon the country. And the way he describes it is day shall withdraw itself. Day shall withdraw itself. A blackout is indicative of judgment. Throughout the Old Testament, and even in the New Testament, darkness, the Hebrew word is choshek, it's indicative of God's judgment because he withdraws his light and he leaves his judgment. He leaves his judgment. It's all over the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, it's associated with Satan and his demons. Jesus, when he died on that cross, there was a blackout. There will be a blackout, according to the book of Joel, before the Great Tribulation. There will be blackouts during the Great Tribulation. And these blackouts that are discussed in the Bible are not a time when there are dim lights or there are minimal lights. It is total blackness. The plagues that came upon Egypt before the Exodus were so dark, one of them was darkness, it caused the people to feel it. This is like going into one of these caverns way down under the ground where when they turn the lights out, it is an eerie, ugly feeling. Total darkness. And that's what God says is going to happen here. We've got these other examples, but the darkness is so strong that it can be felt. And what God is saying here is, I want you to know who I am. I want you to know who I am. Let's pray.